Also, welcome everyone. Good afternoon. Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you all for joining us. This is a new format that we are trying here at TLS. We are still trying to figure out how to call it. We have been calling it amongst ourselves the vodcast or video podcast. The idea is that is more of a conversation kind of approach. And all the information that we're going to be providing today is going to be uploaded on our website, where you're going to have a copy of the recording of this session is going to be uploaded, as well as the audio that's going to be extracted from the recording. We're also going to upload all the resources we're going to be referring to, as well as the handout that is going to be uploaded in a minute here on our chat box. So today we're going to be talking about how to support our students' retention of information and mastery of your course content. We had a 45-minute schedule for this session. It may take a little bit, it can be a little bit shorter, but again, we have a lot of questions and we can take those 45 minutes. Again, we're trying a new format, so anything, please email us, say what you think work, what should improve. We're completely open to all your feedback. My name is Maria Orjuela Laverde. I work as an educational developer at TLS, and I want to introduce today's guest speakers who are colleagues of mine who I've been working with for the past years, people that I really admire their work and their passion for what they do, so I wanted to bring them on board. And you're going to see that all of them bring a different perspective on the topic of today of how to support students' retention of information. And as I said before, if you have any questions, feel free to raise your hand or write your question on the chat box. We're going to be monitoring it and, again, making it as a conversation as possible, like more conversational. We know that a lot of you, it's lunchtime, are going to be having lunch, maybe you're preparing your lunch, so you just want to listen, and that's part of the reason why we designed this in this format, to make it more of a conversation. So I'm going to start by introducing my colleague, Professor Lawrence Chen from the Faculty of Engineering. I invited him because I want to hear his thoughts again on this topic, but from an instructor's perspective. Lawrence has been teaching in the Department of Electrical Engineering for more than 20 years. And as you're going to see, he's very, very passionate towards how to support students' learning and how to enhance his teaching. He's always trying to learn. He's always attending this session. So I'm very glad that he's here. So thank you, Lawrence, for accepting this invitation.
Hi, Maria. Hi, everybody. It's my pleasure to be here.
Okay, and I'm going to introduce now my colleague, Jasmine Parel, who is a learning technology consultant from Learning and Teaching and Learning Services. She brings a large body of knowledge and experience in the field of educational technologies. So she's going to be sharing with us like what strategies, again, to support students' retention of information, but also what technologies you can use in your class, either in person or online, aiming to support this purpose of retention of information. So thanks for joining us, Jasmine.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me.
And last but not least, I am very grateful that Valerie Bourassa, a PhD candidate in the Integrated Program in Neuroscience, has joined us, and she will be sharing her expertise on how we and all of you can design your courses and class activities so they are in harmony with how our brains work. So again, she's bringing that neuroscience perspective to the talk. So thank you, Valerie, for being here.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Maria, for having me.
So I want to start this conversation. I'm still short of breath because I ran a lot, by asking you, Lawrence, what is one thing that frustrates you the most when it comes to teaching, like in your experience as an instructor?
Only one thing that I'm allowed to say.
Start with one.
Okay. I guess maybe one of the things that sometimes frustrates me or frustrates me quite frequently is, you know, when you're in class and you're presenting or you're moving on to new topics for discussion and you ask students about something that was covered last week or maybe a little bit earlier in the course that you'd want to build on for, you know, this week's content, or even ask them something about something they should have learned in a previous class, and all you get back are sort of these blank stares, or sort of, you know, the what is it, the crickets chirping in the fields kind of sound. Everyone sort of says, oh, I don't remember learning that, or I remember vaguely something about that. So it's just almost as if, you know, the information or whatever that they just learned previously the week before, earlier in the semester, just disappeared.
Yeah, I can imagine the frustration. And I actually remember a while ago when I was doing a classroom observation in one of your courses, I think it was signals and something, you asked your students, I don't remember what the question was, but something about they should have learned the previous term. So that was, 3 months before. And I recall this student raising her hand and saying, well, we learned that last term, like kind of insinuating that was so long ago. Why should I still remember? And I remember you saying, well, I learned it 20 years ago and I can still remember. Of course, there are many other factors that come in, but I recall that experience.
Yeah. So I sort of wonder whether, you know, when students forget something or seemingly forget, is it just because, information is so readily accessible? So they just think that, hey, look, I'll just Google it, or, you know, the lecture recordings are available, I'll just go back and look at it again when I need to, or so that they're really not making any effort to try to, store that information in a manner that allows them to retrieve it sort of, not quite on command, but at least get it back when necessary.
Yeah, so, well, actually, you bring that up because there's research that's starting to happen and be conducted on how platforms such as Google, for example, or I don't know, Wikipedia, how they are affecting knowledge retention and in the long term, the mastery of course content. So far, findings are not conclusive, at least not that I am aware of. If any of you has something, feel free to share it and put it in the chat box. But so far, I haven't found anything, and so we have to wait. But I do want to mention, and this is very anecdotal, that some instructors, so as a working in TLS, I do meet with a lot of professors and students, but I do a lot of, when talking to professors, they do bring up this question of, why should I be teaching this content, or why should I be assessing it if they can easily find it on Google, right? So I want to be more in the developing higher order skills or creative thinking, creativity or critical thinking. So I want to spend my time doing that and not so much on this specific facts. And I see where they're coming from, and I see why the question. However, and we're going to post this quote on the chat, which is something that I really like. And it's from a cognitive psychologist. His name is Daniel Willingham. And he says that you can't think creatively about information unless you have information in your head to think about. So it's this idea of those building blocks that we need to have there if we want to get to that phase of being creative, being critical thinkers. So we've been reading a lot about this topic, and a lot of books give the examples. For example, if you're in the middle of your surgery, you would hope that your surgeon, right, does not have to go and Google something when there's kind of an emergency. Or if you are a lawyer and you're in the middle of a litigation, you have to come back and say, okay, I know about this case. So it's like, it's very fast, and that information has to be there available. So knowing this, our question is here is like, how to support students to have that information to stay there, right? To stay there beyond the midterm or the final exam or project or whatever kind of assessment that you implement. So that is why today we have invited, as I mentioned, our colleague, Valerie Bourassa, who's a PhD candidate, defending sometime soon. And she's going to help us understand like some important questions in this matter. So I want to start by asking you, Valerie, what is happening in our students' brains when they are in class, either listening to us or they're reading some class material, videos, or any kind of resources?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question, Maria. So what I'm going to explain now actually applies for any learning experience. So whether you're learning as an adult in, you know, you're learning something at home, or whether you're a child learning at school for the first time, it's the same process. So I want to start by saying that research in the field of neuroscience has been conducted for more than 100 years. And so now for the past decades, we're starting to apply principles in neuroscience to pedagogy, and that's at the level of elementary school, high school, and higher education. So to understand how learning happens from a neuroscience perspective, I want to talk about a few concepts. So there are two concepts that are important. The first one is working memory, and the second is long-term memory. I'm sure you've heard of these terms before. So the process, of course, is a lot more complex than the way that I'm going to explain it. But for the purpose of today's podcast, I'm just going to simplify some steps in the processes of what goes on inside the brains when we learn something new. So starting with long-term memory, this is where knowledge is stored. This is where it's located for long-term retrieval. And the way that this is stored, it's not just putting information on the shelf. It's actually between the connections of neurons, and those are called synapses. So how does the information end up there? Well, working memory, which is the first relay of information, is where whenever you focus on a piece of information, this is where your knowledge is going to end up first. And then if your brain thinks that, okay, this is important enough, we've made a really good connection with this, then it's going to move it to long-term memory. What's really cool is that our brains are potentially limitless in the amount of connections that they can make. And that's why, I don't know if you guys have seen the movie Limitless, that's where it comes from. So they explore what humans could do if they could use the full capacity of their brains. But that's just another story. So not only do we have incredible capacity for storing information, we do it in a very energy efficient way. So researchers have estimated that the brain works on the power of a small light bulb, and that's for billions and billions of synapses. So you can imagine how we're using energy in an incredible efficient way to be able to function this machine. The problem is that even though we have all of this cool things happening in the brain, we also have some major limitations in how energy can be processed and stored. And there are some biases that can occur during knowledge acquisition that can affect learning. So for example, we're limited to how many pieces of information we can hold into working memory. So you don't want to overwhelm your working memory, because then it can affect how information is stored. We as humans are very, very good at shifting attention from one place to another. And especially I think with technology, like I think everybody has their computers on, and their phone close by. So you get a text while you're in a meeting, and then you shift your attention to your phone, and you can do that very easily. And that may make you think that you're able to multitask very well, but there's tons of research that shows that humans are really bad at multitasking. The example that I always give is that whenever people are driving somewhere and you listen to music, so you're on the highway and you turn the music on and you're going somewhere that you've never been before. So you're going to, let's say you're going to Maria's house. You don't know where Maria is, but you have the address in your GPS. And so you drive and you're on the highway and you're like, okay, well, I still have a few kilometers to go before the exit. As soon as you get close to the houses and you have to look at the house numbers, what do people do? They turn down the volume of the music because they have to focus on the house numbers. So we do it instinctively. We don't really realize it, but we're really bad at multitasking. So we try to remove as many pieces of information in our working memory that we don't need. So in the classroom, for example, when you give students instructions for an activity and there's multiple steps, it is very normal that students are going to be overwhelmed and they're not going to remember all of the steps. So you have to find ways to make sure that the instructions are clear. So I'm going to give another example now of how that process works. So when we're exposed to a new piece of information, so let's say I tell you that Maria here is from Bogota, Colombia. So this is new information, I think, for most of you, unless you know Maria very well. So you're holding that information in your working memory right now. And for it to be moved to long-term memory, there's a lot of new neural connections to be made. The first one may be, would be to link that new information to factual information that you already know. For instance, where Colombia is located on the globe. But then you can also have to create new neural links to connect Colombia with Maria. Maybe that's a connection that's never been before. And when those new links are formed, however, they are very, very weak. So if in the next few weeks you come to more of workshops like these and you see Maria more and she talks about Colombia a bit more maybe, then you'll repeat that information and it will strengthen the links. And therefore, you're more likely to remember this in your long-term memory. So going back to the classroom, when students learn something new, even if that information makes it to long-term memory, meaning that they've been studying for a midterm, let's say, and they remember it well for the midterm or the final exam. And they study, so the neural links get stronger. But let's say they go to summer break and they don't revisit that information for months. When they come back to your class and you expect them to have a strong baseline of knowledge from the previous course, assuming that your course builds on that knowledge, they might look at you very blankly and say, I don't remember anything, even though they might have performed really well in the previous class. But that's because they didn't revisit this information. The links in their brains weakened and they're not able to access that information anymore. So the information is not accessible anymore.
So in my case, that means the information is just completely gone from their brains, or?
It's the ability to retrieve the information that disappears. So might as well be gone.
So Valerie, from what you have explained, how can we help students retain that information from one class to the other? So how can we help them not to forget whatever we're teaching them?
Yeah, so there's many ways that you can do so by designing activities intentionally. So you have to create some activities that are built to strengthen their neural connections. And you do that, like I said, through intentional design. So there's another quote that we'll share in the chat. And this is an analogy also that I really like to explain how we can help. So the analogy is that by establishing new neural connection is like blazing a trail through a thick forest, which is a great deal of work. But every time that trail is used, it becomes more established and easier and faster to follow. So it's the same thing for students. Whenever they learn new pieces of information, as they go through it again, it'll become easier and easier to follow. So of course, there are many activities that can be done, and we'll talk about those a bit later. And those are designed to strengthen the neural connections. But one thing to remember is that students are equally responsible for engaging with the material. So even if you do a really great job of designing an activity that will help them remember material better. And of course, there's a ton of literature on how active strategies work really well to do that in the classroom. Students are also responsible for engaging in the material in the way they study. And I just want to take a few seconds right now to talk about note-taking, because note-taking is an example of a strategy that can help students remember information and study for exams better. So one thing that you may not know is that it's been shown that handwritten notes do a better job at promoting long-term memory than typed notes. And there are many reasons for this. The first one is that it takes more time generally to write handwritten notes than to type them. And so our brains are forced to make micro decisions as to what pieces of information are important. And students are forced to then paraphrase or rephrase the information because they don't have a lot of time to write it. So by doing that, they are activating more parts of their brain and it helps in retention of the material. Another reason is that The brain also has different centers for different types of knowledge. So we've talked about factual and of knowledge, let's say of the example with Maria being from Bogota, Colombia, but there's also conceptual knowledge, which is very important for professors as you teaching in the class. But there's also metacognitive knowledge, but procedural knowledge. And procedural knowledge is the way that we can perform different things manually and so on. So writing with your hand is actually involving a lot of procedural knowledge. And so by involving that side of the brain into that new piece of information that you're writing down, that you're paraphrasing and so on, then it strengthens the connection. In addition to that, there's also spatial memory that is involved. So I'm sure that you can relate and say, oh, I remember I wrote this piece of information on the top right corner of my notebook. And because you remember where it is, it's kind of like a memory palace. You can help yourself in remembering what's on the piece of paper by remembering where it's written. With typed notes, however, because when we work in Word docs, as you edit, pieces of information shift around, so you can't rely on spatial memory, and also the procedural memory is not as strong as handwritten notes. So that's why it is encouraged that students at least do some work that is handwritten to strengthen the connection.
That's actually really interesting that you say that, Valerie, because note-taking has always been something that I've really struggled with as a student in class. The cognitive load of trying to listen to what the instructor is saying, what's on the PowerPoint, and trying to keep up and write down the information was always too high for me. Basically, nothing registered when I did that. So even though it wasn't popular back then, whenever I was an undergrad, when an instructor recorded a lecture, I could go back and listen and take my time taking those notes. It was much easier for me to learn what was being said. Otherwise, I just felt like I was getting nothing out of the lecture when I tried to actively listen and write at the same time.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And thank you so much for bringing this up. It's true that for many people that doesn't work. And also we have to think that for some students, it's not an option to handwrite their notes. So we have to think of our student body with disabilities as well. So one of the things that we can do is encourage students to engage with their notes if they have to type them, or if they cannot do a comprehensive note taking during class, but like you said, they can maybe do it at home later and rephrase everything. We can encourage students to engage with their notes in various ways. So there's maybe they could use color coding on their type notes. So then because they cannot use their spatial memory on the document, they can at least use the memory associated with colors to remember some different information. We can also encourage them to break down the information and reorganize them. So for instance, concept mapping is a great tool for doing that, and it will also help strengthen the connection.
Actually, I really like your 2 points, Valerie and Jasmine. I've been trying to use different strategies to have students engage with sort of the class, their notes, and support their learning. But actually, now what you just said sort of makes things, actually illuminates things. It makes a lot more sense now when we look at it from sort of this perspective. So understanding what is really going on inside their brains and how they're learning. So what we really need to do is to help students, I guess, forge the pathways to be able to recall their previously learned information through whatever means possible.
Yeah, this is really interesting. And I love the analogy that you gave us, Valerie. And this is a perfect segue to introduce 3 concepts that they're all backed by science. And as Valerie was saying at the beginning, is researchers, cognitive scientists, and are trying to make that link or that bridge between what the research is saying to what are the practices in the classroom. And that's what we're going to go and we're going to discuss now. I'm going to introduce and we're going to paste the definitions, which I'm going to read in our chat box. But the 3 main concepts we're going to discuss right now are retrieval, spacing, and interleaving practices. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard about this, that you know what it is. And going back to what Lawrence was saying is you may have been using a lot of strategies in your classes. The purpose of this session today is for you to understand and make that link between, oh, That is why that activity works, right? That is why giving students 1 minute to write X or Y, from that neuroscience perspective, that's what we want to do here. So there are a lot of books that we are including in our in the handouts, and all the definitions that I'm going to give come from one specific book. It's called, I have it here with me, Powerful Teaching, Unleash the Science of Learning. I'm going to start by defining what a retrieval practice is. So the authors of this book, they're cognitive scientists, and they define retrieval as boosting learning by pulling information out of students' heads rather than cramming information into the students' heads. So again, here the idea of bringing that information back into your brain, right? And not so much being worried about what it is that we're providing, what information is that we're trying to teach in the class, but actually doing practices to make that consolidation, what Valerie was explaining, strengthen those neural links. And again, going back to the idea of the pathway, which I really like, is activities that, again, going back and forth, that information is there. Because no matter how much information we provide them, if it doesn't stick there, it's right. Sometimes it's like, what's the point? So that's the first one. And I see that Jasmine has included the definition in the chat box. The second and the third definition I'm going to give are based on retrieval practice. So let's say that retrieval is like the base, the foundation for what we're going to be talking about. And then the following to build on that practice. So the first one is, the second one is spaced learning. And spacing refers to boosting learning by spreading lessons and retrieval opportunities out over time, so learning is not cramped at once. So again, going to idea of this pathway, right? If you go once and back, you can start creating that path. But as time goes by, those plants can start growing again, right? So the idea is that if you teach something like, say, week two of class, of the term, week four, you can go back and ask something related to what was taught that week. So again, week five, you can go back to week three. The idea of retrieving that information, and something important here is the idea that it's good to allow students to forget a little bit of that information. So that way, kind of, they do have to work hard on getting that information back. So again, spacing, as the name says, looking into a timeline to introduce the different retrieval practices. And the last one is interleaving, which means boosting learning by mixing up closely related topics, encouraging discrimination between similarities and differences. So the idea here is that if you're going to do retrieval practice, don't do it in a way where students are not able to differentiate between different concepts. So kind of start mixing information. To give you an example, right now I'm helping my son. He's in grade five, multiplication. So the idea, if you're working on multiplication, you can also bring some problems where you talk about addition or you're talking about subtraction. The idea is that whenever you give them a formula, you put a problem, they have to think, okay, wait, what is it that we're doing here? We're doing an addition, we're doing a multiplication, right? So it's not that you say, okay, today we're going to do 10 exercises on addition. And so they know what they're going to be doing because they know that it's addition. So there's a really nice analogy. And as you can see, we're very big into analogies, even though we know that it has its limitations. And this one comes from another book. It's called Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning. And this is an analogy related to sports. I don't know anything about baseball, but I thought it was a very interesting example. So imagine that you have a batter practicing with a pitcher, right? So the batter receives 10 fastballs, followed by 10 changeups, and then 10 curveballs. The batter is going to know what it is that had what strategy to use because they literally know what is coming. But if the pitcher starts changing, right? So I'm going to do a curveball, but then I'm going to do a changeup. The batter has to think fast and retrieve like quickly, okay, what it is that I need to do now. So that's the idea of interleaving, of mixing the information in such a way that students need to know what tool is it that they need to retrieve to use that, answer the questions that you have. So now I'm going to turn it to Jasmine, who is going to share with us some of the strategies that you can use in your class. Again, to enhance these or promote the retrieval, spacing, and interleaving practices, but also what technologies, as I said at the beginning, what technologies you can use if you're teaching online or if you're in your class and you can still want to use any of these technologies. So Jasmine, following what Valerie was sharing about the importance of recalling and creating those paths, to the analogy of the jungle or the forest, between our working memory and the long-term memory, what strategies would you suggest instructors can use in their courses?
Yes, for sure, Maria. So I want to share with our participants today three strategies that are very easy to implement. They require little planning and virtually no grading. And details about these strategies are included on the handout that we have shared at the beginning of the session. I can share it again at the end, so you have it. And we will have this information also available on our TLS Knowledge Base website very soon. So the first strategy that I want to share is predicting. And as you may guess, predictions are an activity that requires students to think about and reflect on questions referring to content that they've not yet been introduced to. And activities that could be used to support this strategy are pre and post quiz questions. And in essence, this is really just sandwiching your content with quiz questions or knowledge checks before you give information in a lecture and after. If you want to implement this activity in a very quick and easy fashion, you could give students a quiz or some quiz questions before introducing a topic in class or online, and you could have them write the answers in their notes. Once you've covered the content that you want to cover, you could ask the same questions again at the end of that section or the end of that class. It's important here to make sure that you have sufficient time allotted at the end to convey the correct answers and to maybe answer any questions that arise as a result of what they might have answered before and what they got after. If you do have some more time to put into planning and setting up, you could use polling at McGill to ask these questions. So students respond to the questions on their device while they're in a live class, and the answers are shared in real time. This is a nice way for you to spot and correct obvious misconceptions on the spot. So Valerie, as a neuroscience expert, could you possibly touch on why a strategy like predicting works and helps students remember content?
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for the question. So by making predictions, students search for information that they already have. So we are making them search for connections that are already pretty strong in their brains. And using those, they can make an educated guess or an educated prediction. So there's another quote that we'll probably share in the chat. So it's another analogy. So we're going to use a lot of analogies in this podcast. But so when the ground is fertile, because the learner's brain has now activated several connections between the question and another possible context. When the answer arrives, the soil takes hold more quickly and firmly because of the link between the answer and those other contexts. So nice quote, really, really like this analogy. So we're essentially taking advantage of neural connections that are already strong to introduce new pieces of information. So that's why predictions works great in the classroom.
So the predictions, they sound like a really neat thing and sort of goes along the lines of inquiry-based learning. So if we wanted to bring more inquiry-based learning into our classes, predictions is a simple way to do it and seems to have a good positive outcome in terms of allowing the students the opportunity to forge those paths between their knowledge and being able to retrieve it.
Yeah. Sorry, I think Valerie, that was for you.
Yeah,
no, it was just a comment. It sounded like something that we could really make use of in terms of trying to promote inquiry-based learning or bring elements of it into class.
Yeah, exactly. You could definitely do that. Sorry, I was there's a lot of cool questions in the chat that I'm trying to answer. So
No worries. Before moving on to the next strategy, I just want to clarify very quickly what inquiry-based learning is, just in case some attendees are not 100% familiar with the term. So inquiry-based learning is an approach that begins with a question or a problem, or perhaps a scenario, that rather than solely relying on the instructor telling the students what they need to know. So in the prediction strategy, you're posing these questions and having students think about a problem before actually teaching them. Or having them kind of uncover the answer. And there's a lot to be said about inquiry-based learning. I think we could have a whole session on that, but I just wanted to make sure everybody was okay with that definition. The second strategy I'd like to share is called free recall. Activities under this strategy might be found also under synthesis and reflection. And an activity that you could use for this type of strategy is called the 1 minute paper. And the 1 minute paper basically asks students to free write everything that they can on a topic or answering a question within a designated short time frame. And typically they're given 1 minute, which is 1 minute paper, but they could be given up to five. So you could be asking a question like something along the lines, tell me everything you know about, I don't know, photosynthesis. So Valerie, why does the strategy like free recall work?
So in free recall, we're asking pieces of information to shift from long-term memory to working memory. So by pausing the lecture, students' working memory will stop inputting. They're going to pause it, and then they're going to grab information from the long-term memory back into their executive attention. So that's where that's where the focus is in lay terms. So every time that information goes back and forth, then you strengthen the neural connection. So that's why it's working really well in the classroom.
Thank you so much. An interesting idea that I had for an activity like the 1 minute paper is to create something that we call journal spaces in my course's discussion boards, where each student has this private space, which is only visible to you, the instructor, and the student to write their one minute paper. And the nice thing about this is that you can use the activity multiple times throughout a course. Students will have that space to refer to it for review. They may also keep that space to make any corrections that they might want to make as the term progresses and as they learn more. Another option is you could also have an open discussion forum for this kind of activity, where students share their recalls in the same space. They can see each other's work. This might be easier for you, the instructor, or other students to spot misunderstandings and possibly correct each other. And it might be a nice way to just easily scan through student responses more quickly to make corrections if needed, especially if you have a large class. And I think it's just important to say that any of these strategies that we share today are adaptable. You can potentially tweak them to fit your context. We realize that everyone has different class sizes, different contexts. You know, you could be online, you could be in person, and a different number of TA hours, and so on. So it's not meant to be a one-size-fits-all strategy. You can get creative with what works best for you. The important thing is that the essence of the strategy is there, and it gives students that space to practice recalling information and supports their learning. And with that, I'm going to move on to the third and final strategy, which is closing questions. And closing questions have students answer questions at the end of a class or the end of a module that have them revisit information that was discussed. And an activity for this strategy is called exit cards. With exit cards, you prepare a prompt that will ask students to respond to in the last 5 minutes of class. So examples of a prompt could be like, what are three key takeaways or three key points from today's class? Or perhaps a question like, what's a question that you have about what we discussed, and so on. And to reiterate again, most of the activities can be done with a simple pen and paper, whether it's online or in person, and a few minutes set aside in class. If you do have more time or want to use different technologies, you can get creative by using things like polling and discussion boards, as I said. You could even potentially have students submit something using my course's assignments. It really depends on the time you have, the comfort you have with the technologies, and what you're trying to achieve. And if anything, you can always contact TLS for help with ideas in what your options are, or help in setting up any of the learning tools. And I think we're actually going to move on to wrapping up. So Maria, I will let you take it away.
Sure. So yeah, thank you. We thought it was going to be shorter, but yeah, we have a lot to say and a lot to talk about. So I see that Valerie has answered most of the questions that were in the chat box. And Jasmine, if you can upload again the simple strategies, the handout, because some people say that they cannot see it. But as Jasmine mentioned, next week, we're aiming for next Wednesday to have all this information to TLS's knowledge base. And we're going to have the handout that we're sharing with you, as well as all the resources and some key takeaways from this session. So again, we are trying something new. We would love to hear from you. If you can send us an email, again, what you suggest we can change, what you'd like, then what other topics you think would be interesting. We would like to expand, for example, on the idea of analogies and also this question that comes up of recalling but misconceptions, right? That's a very, very big topic, and we definitely want to go over it and learn more. So yeah, we're 12:44, about to be 12:45. So I want to thank you all for being here. And we hope to see you next term when we will have our next episode. We don't have a date for now, but we would definitely want to continue doing this. And if you have any questions, again, if you have questions about the technologies you want to use, feel free to send a request to TLS. Or if you want to send us an email with specific questions, we'll be more than happy to follow. So I see that people are saying that great format. So yay. Hopefully this keeps on growing. So thank you everyone for attending. And I think we're going to stop the recording. And again, all information will be up online.